He married his sister. And so then, someone will say, isn't that prohibited in the Bible? Yes, later in the Bible. And someone might say, but, clearly, one of the big problems with close intermarriages is the birth defects and the all sorts of difficulties. Is anybody who's run into, as I once did, a convention of Irish setters, I mean, they're just a bunch of neurotic dogs, and they're all together, and basically all the genetic material for the whole human race and all the diversity of the whole human race was in Adam and Eve at the beginning, and so there was no prohibition of marrying your sister early on, but that was instituted later, and it has been instituted for such a long time that it has taken on the force of a taboo and not just a prohibited thing, but a taboo, which is good and right. So that solves that problem. Moving smoothly to the next topic. As mentioned, I'm currently serving as the presiding minister of the CREC, and my term is going to be up, according to normal doings, this next fall. So I want to describe a little bit about the structure of the CREC and then a little bit about the history of it. And please feel free to interrupt me with any questions that you might have about it. So the structure of the CREC, currently we have 7 presbyteries. There are somewhere between 90 and 100 churches in the CREC. They're different mission plant churches and churches in different states of array or disarray. Right, churches coming and going, but basically between 90 and 100 churches divided up into 7 presbyteries. The presbyteries are named after great figures in church history, Athanasius, Anselm. I'm in Knox Seminary, Tyndale Presbytery, Calvin Presbytery. So rather than naming them bureaucratically, like presbytery code number, code number this, we try to keep it personal and name them after great individuals who stood for the faith. So we have 7 presbyteries. Each of the presbyteries has a presiding minister, and that presiding minister must be the minister of an existent church in the CREC. So one of the things that we tried to do at the beginning, and of course this is a fallen world, and everything we tried to do is not necessarily saying that we've succeeded entirely or that we will always succeed, but what we tried to do is to keep the CREC from becoming a consolidated anything. Generally, denominations gravitate toward headquarters. Headquarters develops somewhere, and that headquarters eventually turns into the Death Star and starts to squelch pockets of life out in the hinterlands where the actual congregations are and the worshiping is. So what we did at the beginning is we wrote into the constitution of the CREC that no presbytery, no broader assembly, the presbyteries or the council can own property at all. All the assets, all the property, everything is held by local congregations, and that the costs of being a presiding minister, if someone serves as a presiding minister of their presbytery, or if someone serves as the presiding minister of the communion as a whole, then the costs of that are borne by the church that he's pastoring, that individual's pastoring, and anybody else who wants to contribute to defray costs. So everything is locally funded at all times, so that we don't have a consolidation that disrupts the faithful witness. I was talking to a gentleman one time in a Dutch Reformed denomination, and he said pithily, no denomination ever went liberal because the pig farmers went liberal. Right. That's not the way it goes. It generally goes the other way. So I think it's a sanctified suspicion, but there is a suspicion of what power does, what authority does. There's a certain kind of person who gravitates to the desk, learns soon where all the levers under the desk are, learns to manipulate things. And so another example is the CRAC at large is not permitted to have standing committees. There are no standing committees. Every committee has to be ad hoc and has to go out of existence when its defined mission is done. So that's part of our guarding against corruption of centralized power. And we do that at the council level, and we do that at the presbytery level. I've mentioned council a couple of times. Council is where the whole denomination gets together, and that happens every third year. So each presbytery has one business meeting a year, and they can get together other times in the year for fellowship and communion and that sort of thing, but they have one stipulated meeting a year because, as this is another suspicion, agenda items expand to fill the time allotted for them. If you have meetings and you don't have a definite closure time for the meeting will go till 2 a.m. And issues multiply to fill the time that is permitted to them. So what we did is we've said each presbytery has one meeting a year to conduct business, and then they can fellowship, get together for singing or, you know, whatever other times. But the business is taken care of one time a year. That's usually in the fall. And then every third year, the presbyteries meet all in the same place. And they meet in the same place. And that third year, the council also meets. So unlike, for example, if you're familiar with the PCA, their general assembly is thousands of people because it's, well, just thousands of people. Council for us is 14 people, two from every presbytery. So a presbytery could have two delegates from every church. Presbytery could have 26 members for a presbytery. That presbytery will select two delegates to council, usually the presiding minister of the presbytery and one other delegate and maybe an alternate. And so each presbytery sends someone. So the presbytery is of a manageable size. And so what we want to do is have the presbyteries meet at the same time that the council is meeting in the same location. And what this does is creates the possibility of the presbyteries and the council talking to each other. So you can there can be some sort of communication. So council meets every third year, and that's the term of the presiding minister. And presbyteries meet annually, and that's the term of their presiding minister. And well, actually, that's not quite accurate, but it could be as short as that. So that's the general outline of the political structure, I guess, of the constitutional structure of the CRC. The history of it. I became post-millennial in my thinking. I was a conservative Arminian evangelical type. And the first big paradigm shift I went through was post-millennialism around 1984, 85. And then I became a Calvinist in 88. And I became probably around 1990, I became Presbyterian in my thinking about church government. I'm guessing there. I became convinced that we needed a broader connection. That was what something the Bible taught. And then I became Paedobaptist in 93, and also in the early '90s, after I became Presbyterian, the difficulty was I was pastoring an independent Bible church type of thing. It had been a Jesus people type fellowship when it was planted, and it gradually became Reformed and Calvinistic and more orderly in its worship and so on. And so there I was, a pastor with Presbyterian convictions and no nobody to presbyter around with. So at the time, our church was called Community Evangelical Fellowship, CEF. And we had, I had mentioned about the decisive point doctrine about a target needs to be both feasible and strategic. Because we were in Moscow, Idaho, and Pullman, Washington, there had been people who'd come to study there who had gone back to Seattle and Wenatchee, who'd been really influenced by our ministry, and they'd started some churches back there. And it was Eastside Evangelical Fellowship in Seattle and Wenatchee Evangelical Fellowship in Wenatchee. And so we were like-minded people. We had historic connections. So when we formed the CREC, we hammered out the Constitution. We debated, discussed. We had visitors and observers from other groups who would come to Moscow for conferences and that sort of thing. So we formed the CR, at the time it was CRE, Confederation of Reformed Evangelicals, CRE. And we formed that with three churches. And this was in the 90s, I think. I forget what year it was. It was dark. They were big. So we formed with those three, and we set it up so that we could. It was all one, and then we divided into two presbyteries initially for the first divide. So it was all just one presbytery, with council being this hypothetical thing that might happen down the road. Then when we divided into two presbyteries, that was Anselm and Athanasius, we divided into two, and we had to have council meetings, because before that, every presbytery was in effect a council meeting. And the denomination has continued to grow. We're very grateful for all the good that God's given to us through it. And are there any questions? Yes.
When you had to say three congregations or thereabouts, how did it transpire that you started to get enough churches in there to add the two presbyteries?
Okay, so we started with three. The three were the ones that had direct contact, like people who had lived in Moscow or gone to school in Pullman, and they'd had direct, strong contact, and so we had strong ties with them. But we also had fairly strong ties with a number of people who would come to Moscow for the conferences that we would do. We did history conferences, and so for example, I think it was the first or the second presbytery meeting, for example, Steve Wilkins addressed us. He was there for the conference. He wasn't part of, at the time, he wasn't part of the CREC, but he gave the exhortation to our men. We had Mickey Snyder was there, I think, at the first meeting, was there for a conference. So we had a number of ministers who would come for our conferences and who were observing, you know, is this thing going to fly? What's going to happen? That sort of thing. So there were, it was not that hard. It was not difficult to get the word out. And so in the early years, we were something of the Cave of Adullam Presbytery, where all the outcasts of Judah would gather. And so what would happen is a church would have some sort of, I call them sociological events. The church has a sociological event. Everybody gets sideways. Sometimes it's doctrinal. Sometimes the camouflage is doctrinal, but the real issues are underneath, you know. But there's some sort of fracture or split, or someone's a church is put out of an existing Reformed denomination. And a number of churches that were in that sort of refugee status knew about us, sought us out, and joined themselves to us. Yes, Brian.
So I'm going to ask a question, and then I'm going to make a speech.
Okay.
So my question is why no standing committees? And the
heard from them, I think it was Chris Schleck, I'm not sure, but, you know, is, well, look what happened to J. Gresham Machen back in the 20s, you know. Look what happened to how liberal the Peace USA mission boards went. But I guess when I look at the history, though, you know, when Machen got booted out or left the Peace USA, he did not abandon the principle of mission boards. In fact, he formed his own mission board so that he could continue to do faithful Orthodox, you know, foreign missions, and the denominations that grew out of the PCUSA and the PCUS didn't abandon the principle of mission boards. They simply said we need to make sure our mission boards remain biblical. And so my concern about that is that I feel like we're weak on missions, even though we claim to be this, you know, post-millennial, reach the nations for Jesus. I think we're weak on missions because we've set up a structure that doesn't allow us to, that only really large churches like Christ Church can afford to do missions on their own. The rest of us out here who are kind of struggling, you know, 60 members, 80 members, 120 members, are not able to figure out a way to work together so that we can think strategically about home missions. You know, we should be targeting Boston for a new church, and we need to figure out a way to pool our resources together so that we can send a man there. We need to figure out how to help people over in Africa or whatever, but we don't really have the time and energy to do it as individual churches, and we have a structure that sort of prevents us from doing it on a more broad level. So that's my soapbox, I guess.
All right, cool. So here's mine. First, let me grant you the central point here is that there is no constitutional structure that man can devise that the sin of man can't work around. Right? So, someone might say, oh, the founders of the United States really messed up when they, with how they framed the First Amendment, because look at our secular society. Look how secular it is. Well, I'd say look at Great Britain. They're as secular or more so, and the Queen is the head of the church, defender of the faith, right? So they don't have a First Amendment at all. They don't have First Amendment issues at all. And the rot of secularism has permeated the UK. So basically, I know that when we set up a device against overreach or tyranny or centralization or whatever, I know ultimately that not having standing committees is not going to be, you know, the sinfulness of man could work around that. And we could find ourselves a denomination that went liberal or went bad despite all our precautions, right? So that point's granted. I think we need to be trusting in Jesus, not trusting in our structures. But we ought to be, as Cromwell once said, trust the Lord and keep your powder dry. You know, we should do what we can. Now, here's the difficult. This is how the temptation works, and I see it very much in the CREC as a small denomination, and that is, it is very difficult to hold your friends accountable. Okay, when you're close and cozy, it's either attitudes get bad and you have a rupture that's unhealthy that way, or it's this person you see twice a year, you pal around with. There's some serious concerns about are they doing the right thing? Is this a good way to spend mission money? Is this a, you know? And nobody wants to raise the question because we're all friends. We don't want to disrupt the fellowship. And it's the perennial problem of discipline. Individual churches without discipline have AIDS. They have no way of fighting off infection. So a church that doesn't practice discipline for doctrinal issues, or a church that doesn't practice discipline for moral issues, can't fight off infection. It's going to die. The same thing is true of boards, committees, presbyteries, and councils. So what you want is if you say here's the mission or let's go heavy into missions, the thing that I want above all is a robust disciplinary system that can, that has protections on it so that it can't go rogue. Right? Does that make sense? So you're always guarding against, okay, if we go this way, then that might happen. As I'm fond of telling our people, there's always a ditch on both sides of the road. If you start to go here, oh, you're getting too close to the left ditch, and if you're correct, you're going to be too close to the right ditch. If you build a robust disciplinary system, you might find yourself with a denomination of three people with two of them under charges. Right? So that's the problem there. If you say, let's just all love Jesus and get along, it's about 10 minutes before the devil starts to exploit that with someone who abuses a privilege or is just too free and easy with things, and nobody will call him to account. And it's a perpetual teeter-totter. And so what I prefer to do is say, yes, the CRAC is not strong. We're not weak in missions, but we're not strong in missions either. You know, it's not a strong mission denomination. It's not pathetic because we do have missionaries and we are doing it. I would prefer to play the long game and say, how are we growing cabbages or are we growing oak trees? What are we doing? So the Catholic historian Christopher Dawson said, the Christian church lives in the light of eternity and can afford to be patient. And that's, I think that that's what we need to do is we need to plant the oak seedling, tend it, take care of it, and make sure that we wind up with an oak tree, a long-term healthy mission that lasts for 100, 200 years, as opposed to short-term missions or short-timing missions that grow and flourish, and as Jesus says in the parable, because the soil is shallow, it sprang up quickly, but then it couldn't bear the heat of the day. So all your points are taken. Yeah, good point. But this is one of those situations where I think everybody has a good point. Everybody has a good caution. Yes.
Could you give maybe some of our members here about being in the CRC and what they're about? And I mean, you said we started in 90s. We're only 20 years into this 90 church. It's pretty solid in that time.
Yeah.
So what encouragement could you give maybe some of them about what's going on in the CRC and what they're part
of? Thank you. I would say that in order to address this problem, we should encourage everyone to refer all questions of coolness to me. and someone says, I think we've identified our problem. So this is one of the, there's certain things that I would argue that we cannot fix or address on our own. We've been in Moscow, we've been praying for reformation and revival for 30 years. You know, we've been praying, it's a regular feature. We have a prayer meeting dedicated to reformation and revival. I believe that if God grants it, I think it was Spurgeon who said, if the church catches on fire, the world will come to watch it burn. I think that's the issue. And if it's a work of the Holy Spirit, I think it will transcend age demographic issues. I think young people, young marrieds, career people, retired people are all going to be interested in something that's genuinely from God. If it's genuinely from God, if it truly is characteristic of a time of refreshing, then I think people are going to flock to that. I believe that people flock to other things for less noble reasons, right? It's the latest thing. It's a retro, it's retro liturgy cool. You know, it's it. We got tired of the Maranatha music, and we thought we'd try something else. And but rearranging the furniture is not the same thing as deep cleaning. And there are many people who try to address the doldrums or the boredom that they have with the last thing that they were trying by doing something that just looks a little different. And that's where we get retro interests and reenactments and fads and so forth. One of the concerns I've had about the CRAC is because we've taken a stand, because we sing weird music, and because we have generally I've been in a lot of CRAC churches, and even though there's a range of you might call liturgical expressions, some higher, some lower, generally they all follow the same covenant renewal pattern of worship overwhelmingly. Weekly communion is common. Not having weekly communion would be radically uncommon. I'm not even sure there are any CRC churches that don't have weekly communion. Children are encouraged to come to the table early in virtually all CRC churches and so on. And that's different enough to attract people for the right reasons and the wrong reasons. Right? And when, even though we're a young denomination, 20 some years old, that means someone could have been born into a CRAC church at the right when we were founded and be a young married now, trying to figure out what to do with their kids. What do we do? And our kids are saying, oh mom, this is this is all I've ever, all I've ever known. And it seems like the establishment, right? For us, for older saints who are in the CRC, and they remember a number of years ago, it was the year Katrina happened in Moscow. Some people organized a joint worship service with all the evangelical churches. We had a worship service, and we took up an offering to help Katrina victims, which was a good thing. So we participated in it. Our people went, and a bunch of our kids, who apparently thought when we talked about pop evangelicalism and what was going on out there, they had apparently assumed that we were lying, and they got an eyeful, like, oh, yikes, are you allowed to do this in worship? Is this okay? And they were eyes like paper plates, and it was like, what? What's going on here? That kind of, in some respects, if we're too insulated, people think that what you're doing is just sort of a throwback, a holdout from the old days, instead of for what it was for most of us was a revolt against the way music and worship had deteriorated. And so I grew up in Southern Baptist circles, and then Jesus people circles, and the contempo everything, and that got old very quickly. And so I and other people sort of turned around and started headed the other way. Let's get out of here. But for kids growing up in the kind of worship that you have here and the kind of worship we have in Christchurch, I think probably the main thing has to be done is you have to teach your children well. Explain, teach, encourage, so that it is fresh from God, not fresh because you rearranged the furniture. I don't think there's any way to do that without loving Jesus, confessing your sins, walking with Him, encouraging one another, just living through the Spirit type stuff. Okay, the question has to do with whether we're involved in any ecumenical efforts, and the answer is yes, but then the question is in what direction, right? What ties are we trying to strengthen? in the constitution of the CRC, we have a mechanism for establishing fraternal relations with other bodies, which has not yet been utilized, but not because of a lack of interest. We've wanted to reach out and form connections with other reformed bodies, etc. If you're talking about ecumenical in the broader sense than that, like outside the reformed tradition, perhaps in some circles as far as Roman Catholicism or EO, there's nothing afoot other than some people thinking out loud about the theology of it. There are too many theological barriers as far as I'm concerned, and we're a pipsqueak denomination, too small to be taken seriously. So I would say there's some people who are thinking about it, and I think there's a lot to be discussed and debated. So Peter Lighthart's recent book, The End of Protestantism, addresses these ecumenical issues, but I think that there are a lot of issues that are raised by Peter's book that still need to be debated and hashed out. Unanswered questions. So I can say that we have a lot of good relationships. The CRC has a lot of good relationships and a lot of good friends throughout the Reformed evangelical world. We have a lot of good connections and a lot of folks in the Reformed evangelical establishment respect our people highly. So there is that. We've got a good place to start from, but I don't think in terms of ecumenical high-level talks, we're not high-level people. And I think I've got 120 seconds to answer one more. Yes?
So what's the main function of the
denomination? The main function of the denomination would be to provide a united voice on issues of common concern, mutual encouragement. Discipline is one thing, but discipline cannot occur unless this is part of the decentralization. Discipline can only occur if two members of a church appeal outside the church, alleging gross misconduct. It can't be the pastor's wife took my parking spot kind of. Not that this pastor's wife would ever do anything like that. It can't be a picayune dispute. It's got to be a high level concern in order for it even to be heard. But in our 20 years, we've probably had four or five court cases, and they were significant. They were significant issues. So discipline is one of them. Mutual encouragement. One voice. So, for example, I issued a statement. I'll just end with this. When the Obergefell decision came down, the presiding minister has the authority of the presbytery and of the denomination, has the authority to speak for the denomination without convening a meeting. So he can speak, and then his action must then be ratified at the next subsequent meeting. So to illustrate, when the Obergefell decision came down, I drafted and issued a statement on the Obergefell decision on behalf of the CREC, and so we could put that up within days, and then at the next presbytery meetings, they all ratified what I had done, and so that's the kind of thing we can do. So I think my time is up. Thank you. All right, Father in heaven, thank you for your kindness to us. I pray that you would watch over us and bless us. I pray that you'd help us quiet our hearts for worship as we're preparing to do that. We thank you. In Jesus' name, amen.